This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, a veteran film executive becomes a director and breaks the rules of the Hollywood cast system. Plus, when Google paid $1.46 billion for YouTube, did it buy itself a pack of legal trouble? But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Don't go anywhere. It's The Business from NPR. The smell of the Hollywood News Caravan. In the run-up to the 2006 holiday shopping blitz, a record 23 new scents have launched by celebrities, including Hilary Swank, Jennifer Lopez, Hilary Duff, and even one named for the ABC television show Desperate Housewives. Last year, celebrity aromas represented almost a quarter of the top 100 women's fragrance brands, up from 10% in 2003, according to consumer research firm NPD Group. We at The Business have created a scent of our own that we've dubbed L'eau de Paul Journalism. In last week's show, we correctly identified Annie Leaver as the dog walker to the stars, though we erroneously said she'd been fired by Renee Zellweger for allegedly spreading gossip. In fact, it was Reese Witherspoon's entire household staff, including Leaver, that was let go because too much gossip was making it into the tabloids and the culprit could not be determined. We apologize for any hardship this may have caused Miss Leaver. In hopefully more accurate news, the orgiastic media consolidation in radio continued unabated. Clear Channel Communications, the nation's largest network of radio stations, agreed to be bought for $18.7 billion by a hodgepodge of investors, including Thomas H. Lee Partners. With 1,150 radio stations and a large outdoor advertising business, it's one of the largest media buyouts ever. In fact, it even surpasses the recent takeover of Spanish-language broadcaster Univision, which was also led by Thomas H. Lee Partners. That's an important coincidence because the Clear Channel sale may mark the first time that federal regulators will have to consider private equity owners as established media moguls in some markets. Hoping to head the FCC off at the pass, Clear Channel said it intends to divest itself of 448 small market radio stations and its TV station division. In other corporate media news, AOL has a new CEO in Randy Falco, the number two executive at NBC Universal's television group. He succeeded Jonathan Miller, who ran AOL since 2002. But it was how Miller was informed of the switch that is worth noting. Per the New York Times, quote, Mr. Miller had periodically been seeking a strong operating executive to help him run AOL, end quote. And at the suggestion of his boss, Jeff Bukas, had recently had a drink with Mr. Falco, quote, he did not know until a reporter called AOL on Tuesday that Mr. Falco was in talks to replace him, according to two people who had spoken with Mr. Miller, end quote. The former head of AOL should have taken the hint when Falco ordered him a Bloody Miller. Finally, over the weekend, Richard Linklater's Fast Food Nation went into limited release in the U.S., but it sounds like Spain needs to see the movie as well. News broke last week that Burger King Corporation is being asked to cease its TV ad campaign for its Monster Double XL burger, the caloric equivalent of eating 10 fried eggs, by the way, because it violates a government initiative against obesity. When a nation whose primary food group is ham and cheese takes issue with your commercials for promoting unhealthy food, you know you've gone too far. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Later on the show, should YouTube be renamed You Sue? Next, every suit in Hollywood secretly wants to direct, but Jeff Lipsky has actually gone and done it. There is an unspoken but inviolate rule in Hollywood that suits are suits and creatives are creatives, and never the twain shall meet. No matter how creative executives think they are, and no matter how smart about business the creatives think they are, that's how it is, how it always has been, and always will be. Amen. But occasionally, a heretic challenges the canon. In fact, Jeff Lipsky has done it twice. He's spent the last 30 years marketing and distributing independent films, from A Woman Under the Influence to My Life as a Dog and Stranger Than Paradise. After heading up New Yorker Films and founding October Films, he fulfilled a dream by writing and directing his first feature called Childhood's End in 1997. Now he's made his second film called Flannel Pajamas. It's the very small story of a couple falling in and out of love.
I love you. Period. I want us to stay together forever.
I've rented an apartment in Brooklyn Heights. I'm leaving tomorrow.
Why?
Because you know the kind of thinking you've been doing the past week we've been apart? I've been doing it while we've been together for the past 2 years.
Jeff Lipsky was kind enough to come into the studio and talk frankly with us about the pleasures and pains of changing roles in Hollywood. Jeff Lipsky, welcome to the business.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin with your background, how you got into this insane business of,
sure,
of tiny movies made with vegetable scraps. It has sort of an interesting genesis because any story that involves John Cassavetes probably does. Tell me about how you got into this and in particular, what influence he had on you.
In truth, I wanted to do what I have now been fortunate enough to do twice, which is make films from the age of 10. My dad would bring Variety home since he was in advertising on Wednesdays, weekly Variety every week. And for me, this was sacred text. I wrote my first screenplay at 12. It was a two-part episode for The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Wasn't sold. The series was canceled, I think, the year I completed the script. When I was 10, I applied for a job as an usher at the Plainview Theater on Long Island. And I was told I was too young. And I dropped it for the next 6 years until I turned 16, got a job at the theater as an usher, and was deliriously happy. Became an assistant manager of movie theaters when I was 18 and a manager when I was 19. And I thought that was going to be my lot in life. I thought I was going to be able to put behind all this passion and these dreams of making films. And that was going to be that. But when I was 17, I went to see a new film by John Cassavetes called Husbands. And despite my tender age, it was my epiphany as a film goer. When I was in college, briefly for 2 years, a commuter college in New York, I was the film critic for the college paper. And I was a decent film critic, but a horrible interviewer. Nonetheless, John's next film was ready to come out, Minnie and Moskowitz, and I was determined to meet him. So I set up an interview with him, and it was a December in 1971. 2.5 hours later, I walked out of the hotel after the interview on Cloud 9, went to a press screening of A Clockwork Orange, and my life had changed forever.
Let's fast forward to when you're actually distributing A Woman Under the Influence, which
is the first film I distributed.
Yeah. That's, of course, a Cassavetes movie as well.
Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about what that did for you and...
Yeah, at the time, my interest in joining his little cabal of helpers to get this film off the ground and into theaters, and remember, at the time, there was only free television and the movie-going experience. So it was imperative that we did everything possible to help John get it into theaters. I thought by sidling up to my idol, it would accelerate the process by which I would become a filmmaker. I didn't realize it was going to take another 21 years.
So you've had this idea your whole life. How do you come out, so to speak? Because this is not something that distribution people are supposed to do.
Yeah.
It's like agents sleeping with their clients.
Yeah.
How do you come out?
Well, you do it by breaking open the piggy bank, first of all. When I mentioned that I wrote a television script at the age of 12, it was just the beginning. I began writing feature scripts when I was in high school and college and while I was distributing films. And I didn't think that any of them were strong enough to risk everything that I had saved, whatever nest egg that I had been able to put away. And along with success as a distributor comes a lot of financial security. But a lot of the people I grew up with, the Bob and Harvey Weinsteins, the Bingham Rays, the Bob Shays, who co-owns New Line, these people went off and they did what most Americans did. They had families, they had children, they got married, they bought a house, they had a mortgage, the kids got older, the kids had to go to college. And a lot of what drove them initially, a lot of the creative muse in their lives, it became much more daunting to risk everything that you were responsible for to fulfill a lifelong dream.
Yeah, Harvey keeps threatening that he wants to direct.
Well, let's remember something. Bob and Harvey actually have directed. They're failed filmmakers, not just commercially but creatively. They co-directed a film that Universal put out called Playing for Keeps. and it was an utter abject disaster on every level.
They've got the need.
Come on, we can make this thing work. We can do it.
They've got the deed.
I need that property.
The hotel is not for sale.
Now, all they've got to do is figure out how to succeed.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the new Hotel Majestic for kids only.
Playing for keeps.
Bob Shea wrote and directed. I don't know if he wrote it. He directed a film called The Book of Love. A couple of them did try their hand at it. And maybe the failure of those films to perform at the box office sent them scurrying away and, you know, sweeping it under the carpet. I hope not, because anybody that actually finishes a movie deserves kudos and high marks. But I think as we all get older, the notion of on one roll of the dice pursuing a passion that really drove you in the first place becomes very scary. I have nobody in my life that I'm responsible to or for. I'm not married. I don't have children. I would like those things, but I don't have them. And so when I did amass a nest egg and I was continuing to write screenplays and I finally ended up writing one that I really believed strongly could make a persuasive, powerful, influential film, I left October Films in March of 1995, a company that I co-founded, and I had the financial wherewithal to go off and shoot a 35mm feature and direct it, something I wrote called Childhood's End. It was to that point in my life.
This was with your own money.
100% of that film was mine.
Which is rule number one.
Cardinal sin.
Do not spend your own money.
Absolutely. And I did it again. 60% of the funding of my new film, Flannel Pajamas, is mine. And if I had the money left to shoot another film next summer, I would do it in a heartbeat.
Does everybody in Hollywood on the business side, do you think, secretly want to direct? And does that color how they do their work?
I think they secretly want to direct or they secretly want to act. It's one or the other. All the people I grew up with, all of the people that run the studio divisions that distribute so-called specialized films now, we all started at the same time. And none of us were out to become entrepreneurs. None of us were out to become film distributors. We wanted to be actors, some of us. Bingham Ray, I believe, was studying acting in college. Michael Barker, who runs Sony Pictures Classics, I believe, was studying acting.
For people who don't know, Bingham Ray ran United Artists for many years. And
absolutely. He was my original partner at October Films.
Right.
But we got sidetracked, and I think we became financially secure. And I think that is the financial security is the greatest inhibitor of creativity that mankind has ever known.
Then I'm the most creative guy you've ever met.
There are exceptions. There are exceptions. And you know, when there's a melding of great art and commerce, it should be saluted because it doesn't happen very often in our lives.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jeff Lipsky, who is the co-founder of October Films and now a director in his own right. His new movie is Flannel Pajamas. What precepts did you violate? You said that you ignored many of the lessons of being a distributor. One of them is, as you said earlier, is using your own money. What are the others?
Well, the other thing is write a script that exceeds 120 pages. The average Hollywood script is between 100 and 120 pages. I wrote a film that I thought – I wrote a script and I kept writing it until I thought it was finished. And that came to 146 pages. Then I wrote a screenplay that was wall-to-wall dialogue. And I don't understand, can't fathom anybody being critical of that. I think in this age of democratization in filmmaking, by dint of the fact that everybody can get their hands on a 24p digital movie camera and some cheap editing software, and anybody who can pluck a couple of strings on an acoustic guitar thinks they're a one-man band. They're a filmmaker. They can make a movie and submit it to Sundance. But the one thing that you can't buy at CompUSA is the talent to write a script or to write dialogue. One of the greatest achievements I ever experienced as a distributor was distributing the so-called cult film, My Dinner with Andre. Well, there has never been a film that was more wall-to-wall dialogue than that. But it's still considered a grievous sin to write so much dialogue in a film. So that's something that I violated. The other thing that I probably violated was by not going after bigger name stars to people my film, to essay my words. I went after the best talent available. And the two leads in my film are Justin Kirk and Julianne Nicholson. And frankly, why they're not superstars is a mystery to me, because they are, you know, I'm sorry, Helen Mirren be damned, Julianne Nicholson gives the best performance that a woman has given in a feature film this year in Flannel Pajamas.
With all your experience and all your relationships, why doesn't your movie have broader distribution? Is it because – well, I'm just going to leave it there.
It's because of money. It's because – I'll tell you what. One of the most gratifying things early on, we world premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in competition. And in the ensuing months leading up to the release this month of the film theatrically, the exhibition community has been hugely supportive. I suppose it's – I've got a foot in the door just because of my history as a distributor. But they're the toughest audience. They're the toughest critics, especially when it comes to specialized films. And I have – had basically the opportunity to already have my film booked in 100 or 200 theaters, but we do not have the requisite marketing dollars to support that kind of a release. We've had to be much more cautious. We've had to, you know, approach it using baby steps.
But if you'd gone a different road and gone with a bigger distributor, problem solved, right?
Well, the odd thing that happened is that despite the fact that Flannel Pajamas was one of the 16 films out of, what, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 submissions at the Sundance Film Festival this year, that not one person who runs a division of a major studio, their versions of specialized divisions, to this day, 10 months after Sundance, has even seen Flannel Pajamas. And I have a pet theory about that. My pet theory, and it's just speculation on my part because I know these people. They're all very fine people. Some of them are hugely creative at what they do and very successful at what they do. But my feeling is it goes back to what we discussed earlier. They also had dreams. And they also – it's not so much that they were dash dreams or hopes, but they've their priorities shifted and they changed. And they've seen me now twice be able to – experience and just, you know, cavil at being able to, and celebrate the creative process in the exact way that I had fantasized about when we were all in our 20s. And I don't think they want me to succeed subconsciously. And the worst thing would be for them to see my film and like it. I think that's why they're avoiding seeing it. God forbid they should like it. And I understand it. I understand it. If I might feel the same way if I were in their position. And this could be bluster on my part. It could be all fantasy on my part.
You said you might act the same way.
Mm-hmm. The answer to the question about why I would spend $300,000 or $400,000 of my own money to make a movie that most of the world would look at as recondite or dense or certainly not something like Happy Feet is after I made my first movie, it was solicited to be in the Hamburg Film Festival. And we did a Q&A and it was great. And we were approached by a young German woman. She had never heard of me. She'd never read any books that said I was some, you know, notorious distributor in America. All she knew was that I was a new filmmaker and she had just seen my film. And she shyly approached me and said to me in English that she saw the day before the then new David Cronenberg film Crash. And it made her so angry she never wanted to see movies again. And now that she had seen my movie, she wanted to see movies again. And if she had been the only human being on the face of the planet Earth that ever saw my first movie, it would have been worth every dime of that $400,000 that I spent. Again, how many people in their lifetimes can ever experience something like that?
Jeff Lipsky is the founder of October Films and now a director. His new movie is Flannel Pajamas. Jeff, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after a short break, just your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man 3 Nightmare. You're listening to The Business from National Public Radio. This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. A trailer rejected by the studio for the upcoming installment of Sony's Spider-Man franchise leaked onto the internet last week. Although, as we've discussed on this show, there's no such thing as bad publicity, there is such a thing as badly timed publicity. How the clip found its way to sites like YouTube is still a mystery, but you can bet the studio's sleuths are hard at work trying to track down the culprit. In the meanwhile, though, they have asked YouTube to take down the clip, and while YouTube has complied, it's still spread all over the web. The episode begs the question, what is YouTube's liability for content that appears on its site? And what does that liability mean for the future of video on the web? James Boyle is William Neal Reynolds Professor of Law and co-founder of the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke University Law School. James Boyle, welcome to the business.
It's very nice to be here.
What are the current rules regarding copyrighted materials on a site like YouTube?
On YouTube, there's lots of different kinds of material. There's material that's put up by individuals themselves, let's say the amazing guitarist Funtu, who did his sort of jazzed up, rocked up Paco Bell canon. He has the copyright in that. Paco Bell's in the public domain. No problem. That's his. No copyright infringement. Second, things that people are putting up in order to comment or criticize. So maybe you might have some news footage of Senator George Allen, and you might say, oh, look at this guy, I think, or former, soon to be former Senator George Allen. Look at this guy. I think there's something wrong with him. That is, although it might be copyrighted footage, it's fair use in most cases. So again, no copyright violation. So the only stuff we're talking about here is the stuff where it isn't fair use and where the copyright holder hasn't already given their permission. Now, with that stuff, that's where some people think YouTube is in trouble. But it turns out that there's a kind of immunity or safe harbor that was created for websites just like YouTube.
And that is what?
Well, it was something in a law called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, Section 512C, for those of your readers who just want to run off and do the legal research themselves.
I can hear the patter of feet even as we speak.
Yeah, or keys, at least.
Yeah.
And what that was, it's an exemption which says if you run a website and you allow lots of people to upload material to that website and you're not scrutinizing each piece, then you're immune from suit so long as when you get a complaint saying, hey, this is infringing my copyright, this individual thing, you take it down. And that's, I think, pretty much what YouTube is going to be relying on. That'll be their principal defense. Say, that's exactly what we're like. People put stuff up. If anyone complains about it, we take it down immediately. We're a law-abiding citizen. We're well within this safe harbor. And it's a very important safe harbor, because without safe harbors like this, really the Internet as we know it couldn't exist. Without another one, for example, of these kinds of safe harbors, Google couldn't copy web pages in order to index them. So we need some degree of immunity from copyright law. The whole thing will grind to a halt. And YouTube thinks, I think, that it's within that safe harbor, and so it's immune from suit.
But what happened to sort of audio versions of this, Nutella and all the other versions or variations thereof? If I remember correctly, the judges basically said that you knew that people were going to do illegal things with this, and you helped them. And that sort of was their downfall, wasn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, of course, there was a lot of legal snarling over whether or not organizations or companies, services like Nutella or like Napster could fit within it. The courts generally held that they could not for a variety of reasons, some of them technical. Those were peer-to-peer systems. In many cases, indeed, the copies weren't residing on the servers of Napster or of Nutella at all. So the court said, well, you see, you don't fit into this kind of category. But you've actually picked on the key thing, which is, forget the technicalities for a moment, the judges showed a great deal of skepticism in those cases, and they said, you know, we think you're designing your business plan right around the boundaries of the law, which, of course, you're supposed to be able to do. That's what we're supposed to know. The law marks the line. I'm supposed to be able to tiptoe right up to the edge of it. But we think that you're a bad actor. We think you're wearing a black hat. We think you're a bad guy. And so we're going to stretch or interpret the law so as to cover what you did, including in a case called Grokster in the Supreme Court. And that's something that YouTube has to be worried about.
That the premise being that, or at least the judge's premise being that you're basically a head shop. You know, you say that you're selling all these pipes and, well, we didn't know people were going to use them to smoke dope or crack or whatever. We're just in the pipe business.
All right. And it's that kind of thinking. And so there is an exception to the exception in this section I was talking about, 512C, which says if you're financially profiting from this copyright infringement that's going on in your system, and you have the ability and power, authority to control it, then maybe you don't get this exemption. Mm-hmm. And that's what the whole fight is going to be over. And when the fight actually goes on, although technically it's going to be on the words, what's really going to be going on is a war of competing metaphors. Your head shop is probably going to be one of them. Another law professor suggested, perhaps unfortunately, that it was the difference between Napster, which he described as the pimp, and YouTube, which he described as merely the hotel, you know, which shouldn't be held liable for what goes on in its rooms. So a slightly more benign metaphor might be, hey, I've got a photocopying machine, I'm Kinko's, you know. You might be violating copyright, but, you know, so if anyone tells me, I'll try and stop you, but right now I'm just running a system, and this is the key part, my system has real public value. I mean, look at the role that YouTube had in the election. Look at the
or in the recent or even in the recent Los Angeles police fracas,
exactly.
where cops are filmed, you know, beating the tar out of people.
Right, and that of course is something that I think, depending on what kind of judge gets it, the court might go, "Hey, wait a minute, this isn't, you know, the head shop. This is one of the most robust areas of free speech we've seen in a long time. Yeah, there's some copyright violation going on here, but this is a good citizen. When they're told that there's individual copyright violations going on, they take it down. Where's the problem? We're not going to chill this speech and stop this form of self-expression and community just to deal with a tiny, tiny marginal we could all debate about how tiny and how marginal it is, area of illicit operation.
What should the law be on this, in your opinion?
Well, that's the real issue. I mean, we can all debate about what the current law is, but I think what YouTube and other institutions like it are pointing out, what the whole sort of Web 2.0, the social web, is pointing out, is the copyright law is fairly ill-suited to what we've got right now on the web. The assumption was it was going to be applied to big industrial competitors. You know, you had a printing press and you were a publishing house. I had a printing press and I was a publishing house. And if I tried to print up the Da Vinci Code, which you had the copyright to, you sued me. Nice and simple. Copying was something only industries could do. Suddenly we can all copy, we can all mash up, we can all, in fact, that's the only way that we can really communicate is to do those things. So what I think we need to do is realize that now this law is being applied to a whole bunch of people, and now talking about the individual users, not people like YouTube, who don't necessarily have high-priced lawyers, who are trying to share things, who are trying to communicate, who are trying to comment on their culture around them. And we have to stop using the sledgehammer of the law that was designed to deal with industrial enterprise to deal with the sort of the light pitter-patter of the feet of the citizen blogger or the citizen video logger, because they're actually doing something that's pretty valuable. That doesn't mean that you have to wink the eye at, you know, blatant copyright violation, but it means we have to acknowledge that the world has changed.
James Boyle is professor of law at Duke University Law School. James, thanks for being on The Business.
It's my pleasure.
A postscript. Late last week, the world's fourth largest record company, EMI, announced they may not strike a deal with YouTube because of just these issues. We'll stay on that story. Oh, by the way, Professor Boyle is also a novelist, and we promised him we'd plug his new book, The Shakespeare Chronicles, a literary mystery about a search for the true author of Shakespeare's works. So there, we did it. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.